Before that, I want to talk about the author who's following in the footsteps of an England footballer by helping to raise money for food banks and children on free school meals. Everyone knows Marcus Rashford became one of the heroes of the pandemic after he got the government to U-turn on plans to scrap school meals over the summer holidays last year. And among our Asian communities, I mean, there are some great charities that contribute to food banks, but can we do more? Well, someone who wants to share her story is author Kia Abdullah. She's pledged to donate all pre-ordered profits from her upcoming novel, Next of Kin, to the Trussell Trust, who support over 1,200 food bank centres across the UK. And Kia joins me now. Afternoon, Kia. How are you doing?
Hi, Anka. I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
No, pleasure to have you on. I mean, this is a cause which is really important and close to your heart, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, to be honest, you know, you mentioned Marcus Rashford, and I grew up in Tower Hamlets, which is one of the UK's worst areas for child poverty. I think the rate now is about 57%, and it may well have been higher when I was younger. Mm. And I benefited from free school meals, but when you grow up and you move on and, you know, you achieve a certain level of success in your career, it's really easy to forget what you went through when you were younger. And so Marcus Rashford's work reminded me that food insecurity is still a massive thing in the UK and just how detrimental it can be. And so I just wanted to, you know, as sentimental as it sounds, you know, I just wanted to give back in a tiny way. And so he really inspired me.
Yeah, and like I said, it's a matter close to your heart. You grew up in Tower Hamlets, and you know, you're a large family you grew up in as well. You're someone, you know, who would have benefited from free school meals.
Exactly. So, look, I mean, my parents had 8 kids, so that was always going to be hard, whichever way you look at it. But I grew up on free school meals. I benefited from them. And it's only now when I look back, I see that it played such a huge role in my mental and physical health as a child. And that of my parents as well. They did really well to shield us from it. But I think even though we never struggled for food per se, there was always a sense that you were aware you couldn't eat as much as you probably otherwise would have. And that was partly because free school meals subsidized us and our bills, but also my parents did really well to shield us. And there are families who are still struggling. I think last year the Trussell Trust gave out 2.5 million food parcels to those in need, and 980,000 of them, so almost 1 million, went to children. And so it's still such a big issue in the UK. And so I'm doing a little bit to kind of raise awareness because, as you say, it is really close to my heart.
And you talked about, obviously, the physical health, but just touch upon what you said about mental health, because, you know, so some kids will really struggle with that. A lot of kids won't want to talk about it or accept it.
No, and it's such a taboo, particularly in Asian culture. And yeah, certainly in my community, there was and still is a pressure to keep up with the Joneses. You know, it's a stereotype, but in my community, parents did compete over how well the children were doing, how prosperous, how successful they were. And no one says, you know, we're really struggling at the moment and we need help. And it's a source of shame and it's a source of embarrassment. And it shouldn't be, because we've all had such a difficult year and people are struggling all over the country. And so I just wish we were a little bit more open about this issue that affects so many people.
Is it changing now, or do you still see that as a bit of a taboo?
I think it is still a taboo. Whenever my family is still in Tower Hamlets, and I go there and I see people who are still struggling, and, you know, because it's the whisper network, but not one person has ever said to me directly, you know, I'm struggling, I can't afford to be. It's such a painful thing as well, because in doing this work with the Trussell Trust, you know, you often want to talk to case studies, but people are still very reticent to talk about it, because of course it is such a private thing. But my mother, you know, she's an immigrant from Bangladesh, but her circle of friends and her neighbours, they talk about all sorts of things under the sun. Mm. But my God, they never talk about, I can't pay my electricity bill or I can't pay my water bill. And those struggles are still there, because you do hear about them, but through the whisper network, you know. Yeah. No one is ever open about it.
Now, communities, as you know, that word sharing, people are so, you know,
exactly,
so conscious, God, of it, aren't they?
Absolutely. And it, you know, it touches all aspects of our community as well, you know, conservatism and kind of being morally upstanding. But money is almost the kind of ultimate taboo, because we have this culture of when you get married and you have these big extravagant weddings, and nobody says, well, actually, I can't afford to have 800 guests at my wedding. And so if you can't even admit that level, how are you going to say that I can't afford to buy bread for my kids, you know, and I've got to use a food bank. And so there's a lot of work still to be done. I don't think it's changing as quickly as it should be.
Yeah, because you go back to Tailhamlish, you speak to people within those communities that you grew up in as well, and you seem to suggest that it hasn't changed a great deal then. And despite the fact that we've just been through a pandemic, which has probably exacerbated the issue around food poverty, you'd think it would change somewhat.
And things like nutrition are so important to the Asian community. You know, we suffer from higher rates of diabetes, and we just need to be A, educated about having a nutritional diet, but B, also just have the mechanisms for ensuring that for us and getting over this level of shame and embarrassment and just being open about the struggles that we're facing through this year that has been so difficult for so many people. And the unemployment rate, particularly among young people, I think in the general population, it's about 5%, but from 16 to 24 year olds, it's just over 13%. And so we also have to look at our youngsters and think, how has this affected them and their mental and physical health? And basically just equip them with the language to be more honest about the struggles that they're facing.
What we're talking about actually touches upon what we discussed on our phone in this morning. We asked the question, why are working class Asians doing better in education than poorer white students? Is off the back of the report by MPs you've probably seen this morning. Yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's part of the immigrant mentality, isn't it? Because our parents struggled so hard, especially in my community, the Bangladeshi community in Tailhamlish. They were the first generations who moved here, and they were working, you know, my dad worked in a factory, they're working in the restaurants, they're doing very manual labour.
Well, was he juggling a number of jobs back then?
Yes, exactly. I mean, most people we knew were. So he would work in a factory and then he would come home and he would work as a tailor along with my mum. So we had these two massive machines in the back of our house that they were, you know, it was a constant soundtrack to our childhood. And that's a very immigrant story. And so it's very natural for them to want their kids to do better. And, you know, that ties into another part of the kind of activism that I do, which is, it's very natural when you're working in a manual job to want the best for your kids. And so that's why we get pushed into the academic and professional jobs so much, which means there's a dearth of creative roles for us. You know, there are so few Asian writers or Asian creatives. And that's another part that really interests me. But of course, I understand why my parents, you know, pushed me towards computer science, for example, or accountancy or law, because they want the best for their kids. And so you have that sort of tiger mum attitude where, no, you guys are going to achieve the things that we didn't have an opportunity to. And so I think that does play, it's a stereotype, but it does play into the kind of levels of achievement you're seeing against immigrant in immigrant communities.
Are we seeing that translate though into opportunities in the workplace in the future for children of immigrants?
Well, I mean, you're opening a kind of worms there, Anka.
Sorry,
I mean,
my brain's in overdrive now, see, after you got started.
Elite fields. I mean, the Sutton Trust do excellent work in this area. And if you look at elite fields, for example, take journalism, which is the field that I'm in. Most, I think out of the top 100 sort of editors and broadcast journalists, I think it's about 57% of them went to private school, for example, even though 7% of the general population went to private school.
Right.
And the same goes for the top judges, barristers and other elite fields, politicians, for example. And so class, which is strongly related to race, but this report shows that not always, it still is such a big factor, and those barriers are still very much there. But we are changing things one person at a time. And so once we have those role models, I mean, for example, Riz Ahmed is doing amazing work and he's a really prosperous actor now. So maybe a new generation of Asian actors will see, well, you know, if he can do it, maybe there's a pathway for me. And so it's all a part of this culture of changing the narrative.
What'd you say to people who will be looking up to you? They'll be, you know, listening to you now. You're a successful author. You're a columnist as well. And in terms of your journey and in terms of what you've had to maybe overcome, what would you say to somebody who's listening?
I mean, look, my advice is always the same, which is don't wait, because there are going to be 100 gatekeepers trying to keep you from what you want to achieve. And so start your own tribe of readers or audience now. So whether that's I'm talking specifically about the creative field. So whether that's a newsletter, a podcast, a blog, you know, social media, start early. The way to get past the gatekeepers is to make your own building. And so it allows you to practice your craft. It allows you to build up a body of work to show to editors when you're ready to move into the working world. And it builds your audience early. So that's the advice I would give. Just don't wait for permission.
And you mentioned Riz Ahmed as well. He's been talking about, you know, accurate portrayals, accurate representation. What would you... What have you made, first of all, of what he's had to say recently? And then just, I suppose, widen that up in terms of what you've been doing in terms of your writing.
Yeah, sure. So he has a really interesting way of describing the creative work that sort of writers of colour, actors of colour have to do. And, you know, he splits it into three categories. He says stage one is the two-dimensional stereotype, you know, the minicab driver, the terrorist, or the corner shop owner. Now, stage two is the subversive portrayal. So this still takes place on ethnic terrain, so to speak, but it aims to challenge and subvert stereotypes. And this is where my first two novels, Take It Back and Truth Be Told, sit, because they very much grapple with things like tribalism, conservatism, patriarchy, and things that I've experienced in my local community. But stage three, he describes as the promised land, you know, where the character's story isn't intrinsically linked to their race. So it's almost incidental. And that's where my upcoming book, Next of Kin, sits. And that's been really interesting because not a lot of publishers allow their writers of colour to just write stories about Asian characters that aren't identity-led. And I've been very lucky to have a supportive editor and a supportive publisher.
Well, that's interesting, because this one is a courtroom drama, is that right?
Yeah, so it's a courtroom drama in which a London architect called Leila Saeed receives a panicked phone call from her brother-in-law one morning, and his son's nursery have called to ask where his son is. And she was meant to drop him off at nursery that morning, but she forgot. And she races to the car park and realises the horror of what she's done. And what follows is a court case that kind of pits two sisters against each other. And through that framing, examines the themes of motherhood and childlessness and the ways in which society treats women differently based on whether or not they have children. Now, as with my other novels, it can be read as a pure courtroom thriller, but it does ask the reader to engage with some broader issues as well. But these are not necessarily Asian issues, so to speak. And so I really enjoyed kind of working in that promised land, as Riz would describe it.
It's interesting because I think, you know, of the success of your two books, let's look at Riz and the success of, you know, his career as well. He's able to take on a role like Sound of Metal, for example. You're able to write a book like this, but, you know, not everybody's going to have that opportunity or platform. And it's interesting, isn't it, that you've got someone who's supportive of allowing you to write something which doesn't have that intrinsic link to that race. But it's not like that for everybody out there.
And look, I completely understand the compulsion to engage with kind of your ethnic terrain, as Riz would put it, because that's really interesting to me as well. So my first book, Take It Back, the framing was a young white girl accuses four Muslim boys of an unthinkable crime. Mm-hmm. And now, do those four Muslim boys get a fair trial, or are they trialed by media? And so that is very much engaging with a culturally specific issue. My second one, Truth Be Told, in that a 17-year-old boy experiences sexual assault, and he comes from a Pakistani family, and it grapples with things like toxic masculinity and the way in which young, specifically Asian men, are expected to uphold these very stringent ideals of patriarchy and masculinity, and how it affects them, and how we can kind of change the machinery. And so I find, you know, the intersection of race, faith, class really fascinating. Some writers don't, you know, some writers just want to write a romance or a sci-fi or a comedy, and they're not allowed to do that just yet. But, you know, there's a whole tranche of writers, you know, like Abhi Mukherjee, Vaseem Khan, A.A. Dhan, who are changing that narrative and showing that we can just write thrilling stories that engage the reader on their own merits. And so it's happening, Anchor, but slowly.
Yeah. No, it's great to hear. And how much, I suppose, a personal story for you in terms of your area where you grew up in Hamlet, how much of your upbringing and your experiences have, have been drip-fed into a lot of your books and a lot of your writing?
So. Yeah, very much so. I think when you grow up somewhere like Tower Hamlets, which is such a melting pot, to coin a phrase, you know, you'd be remiss not to use that in your work, because there is a natural intersection of race, class, and faith there, and the people kind of exist at the sharper end of some of the negative narratives that we've seen in the media. You know, I talked about Take It Back and how former Sim boys were accused of this unthinkable crime. Now, if that really happened in real life, you can imagine the headlines. And so I really wanted to interrogate that. What would happen if these four young boys in Tower Hamlets were accused of a crime, of assaulting, you know, this young white girl?
Yeah. And
it's such a culturally rich area, not just through with Asians, but it had a very strong Jewish community, a very strong, the Huguenots were here. And I remember being young and we had a Holocaust survivor come and talk to us, and he got married at the synagogue that was on Myland Road. And I thought, my God, I walk past this every day and I had no idea that there was this amazingly rich culture here. And so, it's perfect for writing fiction.
And I guess it's interesting now, because that was an era back then. Now you look at it, you know, that's almost like you could talk about a bygone era now. You'll look at curry houses. For every curry houses, you'll see a hipster coffee shop and the gentrification and, you know, increasing rents. What do you make of that and that change? And what have your family said about it as well?
God, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because the literary editor of The Times tweeted something I think it was last year. And he said, oh, I just experienced the most East London moment ever. And he said he was walking past the canal and somebody was in a kayak and said, oh, Francesca, do you remember me from that breathing class in Goa last year? And I, you know, it was meant to be facetious, but I saw that and I was a little bit offended, because I thought, that's not East London. That's not the East London I know. But of course, my East London is not the East London of 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Mm. And so that flux and that, you know, mercurial aspect of East London is a natural part of living. And so I can't claim East London any more than the people who came before me or the people who came after me. Of course, it is sad to see these curry houses shutting down and people who grew up in Tower Hamlets not being able to afford to live there anymore. But, you know, ownership is such a slippery and a tricky thing, and it's so interesting. But yeah, you know, it's not my East London to claim. Basically.
Yeah, it's a lot of people will be asking, will Bangletown even be a thing, you know, in the next 10 years?
Exactly.
So it's interesting, actually. But look, I think it's a great thing you're doing as well with your book. Just to remind everybody, you're donating the pre-order profits to the charity on the Trussell Trust as well.
So they can pre-order at Kia Abdul. For the retail price, they will get a signed hardback, including postage and packaging. They'll get an excellent thriller, if I can say so myself, and they will there will be a donation to the Trussell Trust as well. So all my pre-order profits go to them.
Also, I love the fact that you have an autograph. Most people, I mean, I thought autographs were out of date now, and people just want selfies all the time. So,
well, look, the idea is that it will gain value when I'm rich
and
famous.
Absolutely, absolutely, 100%. Well, good luck with it all. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
And yeah, have a good day. Kia Abdullah, her pre-order book, Next of Kin, you can find at kiaabdullah.com.